The following message was given at Grace Community Church in Minden, Nevada.
All right, we'll go ahead and turn over to Ecclesiastes chapter 6. Ecclesiastes chapter 6. It's a short chapter. We should be able to do this in one night. There is an evil which I've seen under the sun. It's prevalent among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that his soul lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God has not empowered him to eat from them, for a foreigner enjoys them. This is havel and a severe affliction. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, how many they may be, but his soul is not satisfied with good things, and he does not even have a proper burial, then I say, better the miscarriage than he. For it comes, that is the miscarriage, in futility, and goes into obscurity, and its name is covered in obscurity, never sees the sun and never knows anything. It's better off than he, that is the rich man. Even if the other man lives 1,000 years twice, and does not enjoy good things, do not all go to one place. All a man's labor is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage does the wise man have over the fool? What advantage does the poor man have knowing how to walk before the living? What the eyes see is better than what the soul desires. This too is havel and striving after wind. Whatever exists has already been named, and it is known what man is. For he cannot dispute with him who is stronger than he is. For there are many words which increase futility, or havel. What then is the advantage to man? For who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime, during the few days of his vaporous life? He will spend them like a shadow. For who can tell a man what will be after him under the sun? So as we get to chapter 6, chapter 6 ends up sort of wrapping up the section. In fact, a number of commentators point out that when you get to chapter 6, verse 9, that's the first half of the book, and then the book changes character. It changes the way that Solomon communicates. And so as you get to chapter 6, chapter 6 is, in a sense, we could say, wrapping up the threats or the challenges to the beauty of God's plan and to our enjoyment, all right? And as you read chapter 6, it sounds, on the face of it, pretty depressing, right? I mean, this is not like, you know, hey, let's give thanks to God and read Ecclesiastes 6. You might say it's a dark part of the forest, right? If you think of Ecclesiastes as that forest and you're trying to look at these trees, it's a dark part, but it's a necessary part. And I want to suggest that it's not as dark as it seems on the surface. And so we're going to kind of just do a quick review. Reviewing actually helps us see the connections. And if you say, I've already heard this, then that's fine. The question is, did you remember it? Right. Okay. So I don't mind, as Peter says, to stir up your holy minds by way of remembrance. And so Qohelet has given us his, in a sense, his conclusion and his counsel. He's done it three times now. And by that, I mean, he's given us the corner pieces of the jigsaw puzzle, right? The first one was at the end of chapter 2. The other one was at the end of the poem on time. And then the other one is at the end of chapter 5. And what you end up having is you end up having these summations that really are his conclusion to the things that he's wrestling with, that he's struggling with. And they boil down to this. Life is a vapor. Life is a gift. Enjoy the life that God has given and the labor that he's given you to do. And so in the midst of mystery and in the midst at times what seems to be absurdity in the midst of wrestling with a really, really short life, a life that's filled with toil, and sometimes a life that's just filled with pain. Kohelet's advice to us is step back, see it as a gift from God, and enjoy it for what it is. It's going to be over soon. Now, what he does after those pieces, in a sense, especially as you get to chapter 3, he starts to unfold what are threats, right? So he says in 3:1-14, basically, God's appointed a time for everything under heaven. He's making all things beautiful in his time. You have a desire to know what he's doing. God's not giving you the ability to know that, but there is still this sense that you know everything's happening for a purpose and it's going to be beautiful in its time. And so there's going to be things in life that seem to go contrary to a beautiful plan, right? Then there are also things in life which are genuine threats to us enjoying life as a gift. And so that's the way I see the end of 3, 4, 5, and 6 working together, is that they're all dealing with these issues in life that seem to threaten either the beauty of God's plan or our ability to enjoy life and labor. And so we saw the challenges to God making everything beautiful, chapter 3, injustice, chapter 4, oppression, the challenges to enjoying life and labor as a gift. You have envy, loneliness, politics, which you could argue actually also is a threat to making God making all things beautiful, right? Because politics are so ugly. And then shallow and careless worship, 5:1-7. And then he shifts back, challenge to God making everything beautiful, graft in high places, 5:8-9. And here, the oppression and the injustice that Kohelet wrestles with is really brought about specifically in this passage by bureaucrats and kings and politicians and those in office. And then there are the challenges to enjoying life and labor as a gift. One of those is loving money. Okay? You love money, you will destroy the gift quality of life. And then hoarding money and losing money, right? All of those things seem to mitigate against genuine enjoyment of life. Now, I will just remind you that what Solomon is writing against is not the idea of saving or wise stewardship or even investing. In fact, we're going to see later, he's going to encourage you to wisely invest. The problem that he deals with in those passages is thinking that money could secure your future. The minute that you think money can secure your future and you start to hoard it, the minute that you lose it, that person loses everything because that's all they have. And so he recalls for us at the end of chapter 5, really the remedy, and this is the third time that he's given us the corner piece to the puzzle. But in chapter 5, verses 18 to 20, he does add one additional piece, right? And that's verse 20. For he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. Now, this is a part of the summation of enjoying life and labor as a gift from God. But here, there's a little added bit of information that Kohelet has not given us to this point. And that is that a life that is a busy life, but a busy life that is enjoying that life and that labor as a gift from God, that enjoyment in the midst of that busyness brings a contentment to life. And although life is a vapor, the contentment makes that life a blessed life. So there's a sense in which the happier, more joyful, and more content we are in God, the more preoccupied we are with living for God, serving God, and enjoying His gifts, the more preoccupied we are with those things, the faster life goes by. But at the end of the day, you would not trade the vapor of a blessed life for the slow fires of a miserable one. Right? Misery does slow down the clock. Happiness speeds it up. I wish it were the other way around. I wish misery would go by at lightning speed and the happiness would just seem to just last forever. But it doesn't work that way. And so as Solomon gets into chapter 6, he's going to continue the themes of both money and work. And at this point, you might just sort of just scratch your head and say, have you not talked to us enough about money and work? And I think Kohelet would probably say, no, I don't think so. I don't think so. Now, as we get to the end of this chapter, really verses 10 to 12 go with chapter 7. Verse 9 is the conclusion to the first part, but we're going to see that it kind of changes up a little bit. We're going to see more loosely connected themes that are being brought together. But the question is, as we look at chapter 6, as we come to a conclusion to the first part, why does Solomon spend so much time dealing with money and with our work or our labor? One of the reasons is because work is a major part of your life. And if it is a gift from God that is to be enjoyed and balanced with rest, but it also has the grave potential to bring misery to you, you need to have this beat into your head. What about money? Well, we earn money through the work that we do. Our labor and income or money's the reason why you work. I mean, not me. I just do this because I wouldn't want to do anything else. Somebody asked me one time, you know, you go to these conferences and they do these little interviews and they always say, hey, so what would you do if you weren't a pastor? And I do. I say, I can't think of anything else I'd rather do. I mean, really. It's the most joyful thing I could ever dream of. Well, come on. I mean, what if you couldn't be a pastor, what would you do? And so I usually freak them out a little bit and just say, I'd be a sniper. That usually ends the conversation. But work is a gift, and then God provides money through your work. But both work and money pose a genuine threat. They both can easily spoil life because we expect more out of them than what God has intended them to give. And so, why does Solomon just keep beating this drum? Why does he keep plucking these two strings on his guitar? It's because the way that truth shapes us is truth doesn't just shape us quickly or easily, does it? I mean, I wish it did. Truth is not just learned first time around. You don't change your worldview after one lecture. You don't change your worldview because you read a paragraph. Truth needs to be kneaded into our hearts and our minds so that it becomes a part of us. And I think for Solomon, we're going to see there's a connection to Solomon early on that is in this passage. For Solomon, it is vitally important that these truths, especially regarding work and money, become a way of thinking for us. So that this is the way that we think about the work that God's given us to do. And this is the way that we think about the money that God provides through the work that he's given us to do. Now, the first six verses, I just called it the gift of enjoyment withheld. And this is just totally depressing. So, just hang on. I can't promise you that we'll get to anything cheery tonight, but you know. So Solomon says, there's an evil which I've seen under the sun. It's prevalent among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that his soul lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God's not empowered him to eat from them, for a foreigner enjoys them. This is havel and a severe affliction. So Solomon's now talking about this person, right? And the person in question is one of Kohelet's hypothetical unfortunates. All right? Now, maybe he had people specifically in mind that he knew over the years, but he's setting up a person, a hypothetical person, to, in a sense, use as a model or an example. And this guy has everything. He has wealth, he has possessions, he has honor or abundance, he has children, and then he dies. And so, the question is, for the guy who has everything, what's missing here? Well, what's missing in this outwardly blessed life is the ability to enjoy the blessing. So I want you to hear this. This guy is, from all biblical standards, old covenant standards, this guy is the poster child for being blessed. He's got the blessed life, and yet the one thing that's missing, in a sense you could say, the only thing that's missing is his ability to enjoy the blessings as a gift from God. And because of that, Solomon's going to conclude a stillborn baby is better off than that guy. So the evil stated, by the way, when you see evil in Ecclesiastes, it's not always the idea of that which is morally or ethically reprehensible. Sometimes evil, from Solomon's perspective, are just the, in a sense, sort of the dark hues of a fallen world. Evil is sort of the, at times, the vandalism of Shalom. Evil is simply another way to describe the way things ought not to be, but actually are. Evil is compounding the vapor of life with affliction. And so, Daniel Fredericks actually translates this verse, and this captures, I think, it very well. There is a tragedy that I've seen under the sun, and it's overwhelming for humanity. But this tragedy, this evil of marrying together vapor and affliction, is also incredibly common. He describes the hypothetical unfortunate guy. We could call him the poor rich man. Right? This is the man, and notice who gives, to whom God gives riches, wealth, and honor. You know what's interesting? Those three phrases are used twice in the Old Testament. Once in 1 Kings chapter 3, and the other in 2 Chronicles chapter 1, and they're both a reference to Solomon. Of what Solomon was given by God. All right? So, do you think that maybe there's at least a twinge of autobiographical reflection here. Well, there's probably a good chance. And so here's the result. God's given him, he's given him money, he's given him wealth. He's, when it says honor, it's the word kavod, glory. So that's why we do honor. But it could just be the idea of a superabundance as well, right? And so here's the result. His soul lacks nothing that he desires. In other words, this guy has everything. But the thing that he's missing, and this is important to see, God has not gifted him with the power to enjoy it. Where do I get to enjoy it? To eat from them. That is to participate in and partake of the blessings that God has given. And then on top of that, a foreigner who didn't work for it, by the way, that's the implication, enjoys all the stuff that God gave this guy, but withheld the ability to enjoy it. Now, yeah. You have to use a little bit of imagination here, right? So here's, let's say here's this Jewish businessman, and he's working hard and he's absorbed in his work, and God gives him wealth. He gives him possessions. He gives him a superabundance. He gives him, let's just say, honor. He gives him, a name, and then a Gentile gets it all. That's what we would call adding insult to injury. Okay. Now, notice in the passage, there's no reason that's given as to why God keeps him from enjoying his labor, nor is there any reason why God gives it to a foreigner instead of a family member. Right? No reason. Now, I don't want to make too much of this, but let me just say, God doesn't owe us a reason. I might really want to know why. Lord, why would you fill this guy's basement with cans of peaches and then not even give the guy a Swiss Army knife? Doesn't tell us. Maybe this is Kohelet's not so subtle way of just reminding us that God in his absolute sovereignty is not responsible to us. He's not accountable to us. He doesn't need to explain why he does what he does or doesn't do. I mean, by the way, if you don't come to grips with that, you're going to live a pretty messed up theological life. And then you're just going to live a pretty messed up life, right? God does not owe us an explanation, ever. And so here he is, gives this guy all this stuff, and then says, and I'm not going to give you the power to enjoy it. And then here's Kohelet's conclusion. He says, this is a vapor. Everything's a vapor, right? So good stuff's a vapor, neutral stuff's a vapor, bad stuff's a vapor. This is a vapor, and then he says, and a severe affliction. So you know what happens when you take the word vapor, and then you take the word severe affliction, and then you put them together, you have to understand that that is an intensification of the pain of living a very short life. If that short life is mixed with severe affliction, it is a compounded burden. Now, I think the same guy is in view in verse 3. Doesn't have to be, I think it is. If a man fathers 100 children, okay, I know some of you are trying. Okay, 100. By the way, that's more of a metaphor for like the perfect number, right? Of, let's just say, an overflowing quiver. Okay? If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, however many they be, but his soul is not satisfied with good things and he does not even have a proper burial, then I say better the miscarriage than he. So when you get to verse 3, you end up having, by the way, so think of these two things, 100 children, long life. Psalm 127, children are a gift from the Lord, right? Blessed is he whose quiver is full, right? So lots of children, blessing from the Lord, right? Long life, is that also a covenant blessing under the old covenant, right? So both of these are covenant blessings. So here's a guy who's like on the outside, long life, oh, that guy's blessed. Lots of kids, hey, that guy is blessed. But here's the problem. He isn't satisfied with the blessings. And then he dies. You could say something like this, and the guy doesn't even get a headstone. By the way, in more ancient Jewish tradition, and I think that you still see some of this residual even among contemporaries, right? The idea of a big funeral where lots of people are there and there's much made of the dearly departed and lots of nice words are said and it's a big shindig and there's great food afterwards. A really, really, really good funeral was often seen to be the way to just sort of cap off a really blessed life. So this guy had blessings in life. He didn't enjoy them. And in death, not only did nobody show up to his funeral, he didn't even get a funeral. It's tragedy, right? Absolute tragedy. Solomon's conclusion is this. Hey, it's better that he would have never lived. Wow, think of the implications of that. I mean, when you read that in the Gospels, when Jesus is speaking about Judas Iscariot, it would have been better for that man never to have been born. Isn't that chilling? Solomon says the same thing here, and it's not about the one who betrayed the Son of God. It's simply the one who utterly fails to enjoy the blessings of God and then dies and is forgotten. Don't you think it's interesting? Rich guy? What do rich people have, according to the Proverbs? A lot of friends. You got 100 kids? You'd think somebody somewhere might have just said, hey, where's dad? He's down at the morgue. Well, what do you think we ought to do? Well, I think we probably ought to go and get him and put him in a box and have a service. That sounds good. Nobody even thinks that. And so the guy who lives and never could get any satisfaction in life ends up dying, having this outwardly blessed life, but not even having 1 out of 100 children that would even take time to bury him. Solomon says that's a sickening tragedy. By the way, if this doesn't challenge you to rethink all of your prosperity theology, I think it probably should. Right? I mean, in a sense, what's it all worth? Verses 4 and 5 are pretty dark. 4 and 5 describe a stillborn child. The stillborn child comes in a vapor, right? You get the idea. Just a breath, brief, goes into darkness. In darkness, its name is covered in obscurity. It's interesting. That little phrase its name, the stillborn child's name, is covered in obscurity. Michael Eaton, a Hebrew scholar, says the name in Hebrew thought is more than a label. It includes the personality and the character. The stillborn child has no chance to develop a character or acquire a reputation. This little one never sees the sun. This little one never learns anything. It, the stillborn baby, is better off than the guy described in verses 1 through 3. Now, if you notice, if you have the New American Standard, you will notice that it kind of leaves something out that the ESV includes. It's not enough to tip me over to using the ESV, but notice verse 5. It never sees a son. It never knows anything. It is better off than he. The ESV actually has what reflects the Hebrew text. It's not just better off than he, it's he has more rest than that one has. By the way, rest is not just the grave, because the rich man died too. You do see that, right? This can't just be going to the grave. They both go to the grave, right? Everybody just goes to the grave, Sheol. But the rest here that is described is a state in the afterlife that the unborn or the stillborn has that the rich man doesn't. And so Solomon then says, I want to just make my point. I want to make sure everybody gets this. Even if he lives 1,000 years, twice. Now, who lived the longest in the Bible? Methuselah. How old was Methuselah? 969. Right? So Methuselah didn't even make it to 1,000, but he almost did, all right? By the way, 1,000 is the ideal period of time, okay? And so Methuselah almost makes it. And so Solomon says, even if this guy lives 1,000 years, twice, right? You get the idea. This guy's not just long life, the blessed life. This guy has like the super energized bunny life, all right? And he does not enjoy good things. This guy has 2,000 years to enjoy God's good gifts to him, and he doesn't do it. And guess what? He goes to the grave just like the stillborn child. And so one commentator says this. He says, it's the quality of life to which Kohelet is referring, not its duration. If one is denied to enjoy one's life, then one is better off never entering the world at all. Ample opportunity to enjoy God's blessing. But he never did. That stillborn baby's better off than he is. You know, the Jewish people had their own version of prosperity theology. If you were rich, you were blessed. If you weren't, you weren't blessed. If good things happen to you, that's God's favor. Bad things happen to you, you've done something wrong. Now, sometimes this is called retribution theology. God gives external blessings to people that do good, and then he gives painful things to people that do bad. And there are actually three people in the Bible that exemplify this in the worst possible way. Job's three friends. Job's three friends operate on the basis of a prosperity or a retribution theology. It was very common to assume that a rich person was blessed by God. Think of the parable of the rich man and Lazarus in Luke chapter 16. Think about when Jesus says it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to be saved. You know what the disciples do? They're like, yep, you know what? Those one percenters, I knew it, I knew it. It's not what they said. They said, then who can be saved? Why? Because rich people obviously have the favor of God. And what this passage does is this passage absolutely obliterates the link between prosperity and God's favor. Is it possible to assume because of external blessing that you have God's favor? And the answer is yes. Is that always true? And the answer is no. So this text, it breaks the conventional paradigm. And in fact, if you read it and you're like, you know, 1,000 years twice and he still doesn't enjoy, you know, the good things that God's given, then what's going on is these are Jewish fingernails going down a Jewish chalkboard. Because if money and kids and long life are blessings, then doesn't that automatically mean that the rich man is spiritual and on good grounds with God? And Kohelet says, no. That guy that you envy because he lives to be so old and he has all that stuff and he has all those kids, yeah, that guy sure does have tents and tents and tents full of cans of peaches, but he's never in his entire life been able to open up a single one. And so the graceless rich man with a full quiver doesn't demonstrate anything in terms of his true favor with God. And what gets underscored in this text is that God is sovereign. God is sovereign. In verses 7 to 9, the limited benefits of labor and wisdom. So some of this, it gets a little tricky. So verse 7, all a man's labor is for his mouth, and yet the appetite, literally, the soul is not satisfied. Okay. So, in a sense, Solomon's saying probably something like this: we work in order to eat, and we in turn eat in order to work, but working to eat never actually really satisfies your deepest longings. I think that as you get to these three verses, 7, 8, and 9, it's somewhat serving like a summary, underscoring the fact that if you reduce life to working to eat and eating to work, it'll never bring you the satisfaction that you're really looking for. And so there's the Jewish rabbi standing there, and he says, well, of course, you can't just work to fill your appetite and expect it to satisfy you, because what you really need is you need wisdom. And we go, well, that sounds pretty good. I mean, who would be against wisdom? Well, nobody. In fact, Kohelet's not against wisdom. But just notice verse 8. For what advantage does the wise man have over the fool? What advantage does the poor man have knowing how to walk before the living? Now, this verse is sort of difficult, but I would say that what Kohelet's after here is to point out to us that even wisdom is not the ultimate answer, and even wisdom is not the ultimate satisfaction. And so Kohelet, does he value wisdom? And the answer is, of course he does. Of course he does. But he never overplays wisdom's hand. Wisdom, human wisdom, even that which comes down from above, from God, is still limited in its value in this life. Why? Because the wise man and the fool both die. The wise man might live a little longer, certainly probably happier, but guess what? Wisdom is not the ultimate answer to anything. What about this poor guy that he mentions? Well, it looks like you've got this poor guy who's got social skills and knows how to get along with people, to live in front of people. And I think Solomon's saying, you know, neither of these things work towards ultimate satisfaction. And then he makes this really odd statement. The seeing eye is better than the wandering desire. Notice the way he puts it. What the eyes see is better than what the soul desires. It's interesting. In Kohelet, what are seeing eyes? Well, in Kohelet, seeing eyes are a reflection of wisdom. Right? We're going to see actually a little bit later. The wise man has eyes in his head. He can see. There's a level of understanding. Seeing eyes could also be a reflection of the ability to enjoy the gifts of God because you see that they come to you from God. Right? And so what the eye sees, That is the wisdom that you possess and the knowledge that you possess that life is a gift from God, that is better than the wandering desire. The picture of in the second one is this person who's in continual motion, fluctuating, vacillating, driven by desires to obtain things that they never are able to obtain. Have you ever met anybody who is always into the next multi-level marketing scheme? Okay, so this is just an extreme example of what Solomon's talking about. It exists without such extremities, but let me just say that this person is they're flittering around like a hummingbird. And they go, oh, there's an opportunity. There's an opportunity. And they never even complete one. They're always on to the next one because they're being just driven by their own desires. Compare that to the person who actually has some stability because he has his eyes in his head. He's got wisdom. He sees life as a gift from God. That gives him a stability. The person that doesn't have that is just like the little hummingbird that's just buzzing all around trying to obtain, trying to acquire, and actually never does. You ever meet anybody like that? And then Solomon just says, this too is Havel and chasing the wind. What's Havel? All of it. All of it. Now don't let this depress you. Is it better to have seeing eyes, right? Of course, it's better. It's better. Is it better to have wisdom, and is it better to employ that wisdom and to have a life of gratitude to God because you see the good gifts that he's given? Is that better? Yeah, absolutely, right? Is it worse? Far worse, to be the person that has that drive that's always pushing them here and there, trying to acquire, trying to obtain, and they never do, and they end up dying alone. They end up dying, eating in the dark, all the things that Kohelet has described, right? So which life would you rather live? Well, I'd rather live the seeing eyes life, right, than the empty soul life. But both of them are a vapor. Both of them are a vapor. You see, at the end of the day, the real question is not how do you prolong the vapor, because you can't. The question at the end of the day is how to make the most out of the vapor that God's given you. That's what it's about. That's what it's about. And so, John Piper, Don't Waste Your Life. Anybody remember, read that book? Great book, by the way. Powerful book, right? I think Kohelet would say, you know what, John? I can do better. Don't waste your vapor. Right? Don't waste your vapor. Now, you get to verses 10 to 12. And 10 to 12 goes with the next section. All right? So there really is sort of a somewhat of a clean break in verse 9 and then 10 to 12. And you can kind of see how this will end up working out. But on Sunday, I want to preach the first part of chapter 7. And I don't want to have to, like, wade through this part. So you guys are blessed to wade through these three verses with me. Now, I throw this quote in from Daniel Fredericks because he helps us see. He says, the frugality of the 15 Hebrew words in verse 10 has somehow produced a proliferation of large, historic, dramatic, and theological interpretations that span the Garden of Genesis to the ash heap of Job. So what is he saying? The number of interpretations that are found from this verse are legion. One of the problems is that you only have 15 Hebrew words in this verse. By the way, this is what makes sometimes the Proverbs so difficult to translate and to interpret, is because they're so brief, they're concise, they're terse, and so you have to, you're left to kind of fill in the blanks. Well, guess what? You're left in verse 10, all right? So as you get to verse 10, here's how I would put it, all right? I'm going to say verse 10 has an overarching theme, and then there's three things about it. And I would say verse 10 is the dirty Harry Callahan verse. This was Harry Callahan's life verse. You guys know Harry Callahan, right? Wow, you're deprived. You're gonna have to come over. We're gonna have to have a dirty Harry night. All right. Clint Eastwood, Inspector Harry Callahan, San Francisco Police Department, and he has a lot of famous lines, and one of them just goes like this: a man has got to know his limitations. That's what verse 10's about. A man has got to know his limitations, right? And so there are three things about that, and I'm going to put this in just pretty basic terms. Number one, things are pretty much settled. Number two, everybody knows what a man is. Of course, that's news today, but... And then number three, your arms are too short to box with God. Okay? That's verse 10. That's verse 10. And so if you just, I'll show it to you. So whatever exists has already been named, right? Things are pretty much settled. You know, for all the stuff that we think we discover and all the stuff that we think we, you know, we come to investigate and explore and all of this, you know, they're really... Let me just say this. Big deal. Big deal that you got a camera down into a dark part of the ocean and saw a fish that's so ugly that no human being has ever seen it before. And we act like we've really done something. And God says, I've seen that fish for, 10,000 years, and I made it that ugly, and I kind of enjoyed it. Right? So everything's settled. Whatever you think that you're going to discover, whatever you think you're going to learn, whatever you think you're going, we sent out the Hubble telescope or whatever, and we think, wow, look at all this. And there's a sense in which it's just like, you know what? This stuff has been here all along. It's already been named. It's already settled. Know your limitations. The second line is pretty clear, too, in the sense that he says, and it is known what man is. Now, we could, of course, make jokes about that and say we don't even know what a woman is today, right? Or how can Kohelet say that? He's not a biologist. Okay. But here's the point is that human beings aren't too hard to figure out. You know what a human being is. This marvelous and mangled mess. That's what a human being is. A marvelous image bearer. Mangled, depraved mess. No rocket science here. Freud and Jung and all of those yahoos really didn't do much of anything, did they? By the way, if you don't know what man is, you can't ever help anybody. If you're a bag of gas in a three-piece suit or your molecules in motion or whatever, then you're not really responsible for anything you do. But you start to understand the majesty of man and then the depravity of man. That will give you a framework to explain why in one race you have a Mother Teresa and a Joseph Stalin. So Solomon says, it's not rocket science. And then your arms are just too short to box with God. You can't dispute with him who's stronger than he is. You might want to argue about it, but guess what? You're not going to win. And so man cannot escape his limitations. And he cannot completely unravel the world's anomalies. We already saw that back in chapter 1. And he might, like Job, really, 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 really want to debate with God. But at the end of the day, God's going to be like, okay, who's the fault finder here? What is this guy doing? Right? Let me ask you a few questions first. Puts him in his place. Verse 11, pretty simple. For there are many words which increase vapor. What then is the advantage to man? I love the NET Bible. It says, the more one argues with words, the less he accomplishes. How does that benefit him? I will tell you, this should be Zuckerberg's verse that he puts on every Facebook homepage. The more one argues with words, the less he accomplishes. So verse 11 just reminds us at the end of the day that all the talking in the world isn't going to change any of the things that he's already said are fixed, right? In fact, when there's an abundance of armchair theologians and armchair philosophers and then throw in a few lawyers who are actually railing against God's ways and piling up their words, Solomon says, you know what it's like? You're just like piling up gas. Vapor, of course. And so what good does it accomplish? Talk all you want. It's not going to change anything. even if you are wise. Verse 12. Now, verse 12 sounds a little pessimistic, but I don't think it is. For who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime, during the few years of his vaporous life? He'll spend them like a shadow, for who can tell a man what will be after him under the sun? By the way, chapter 6, verse 12 is one of the clearest verses that underscores that Havel is not futility or meaninglessness. Why do I say that? Well, because the text says, for who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime, during literally his few days of a vaporous life. And then, just to make sure you get the point, he will spend them like a shadow. Okay? So this life is this vapor, and it goes by like a shadow. And of course, you know, the idea is that the turning of a shadow is something that happens, and it happens with relative quickness. And so he asks this question, who knows what is good? Now, by the way, if you read Ecclesiastes negatively, like Kohelet is the pessimistic sage, then how do you answer that question? Who knows what is good? Nobody. Is that his answer? Not at all. By the way, he's already answered this question earlier, back in chapter 2, back in chapter 3, every time he's turned around and said, it's better. So don't think that this question is, well, who knows what is good? Well, nobody knows what is good. That's not true. The wise man who knows God knows what is good. Then notice, life is a shadow. By the way, Job, Psalms, 2 Chronicles all use the metaphor of a short, short life like the turning of a shadow. And so, who knows what is good for a man during this short, vaporous life? Well, the wise man who knows God knows what's good in this short, vaporous life. And then he says this, for who can tell a man what will come after him under the sun? Now, the answer to that is that you don't know what's going to come after you when you die under the sun. Okay. But here's the thing. Who does that bother? Who does that torment? Well, it torments the guys that are described for us in chapter 4 and in chapter 5 and then in chapter 6. Not knowing what's going to happen with all of my stuff, that only bothers people who are just all about their stuff. If you know what's good, you don't know what's going to happen with everything after you die under the sun. But you know what? That's okay. That's okay. You know, there are times where I have these peculiar moments where I'll be sitting there reading one of my favorite books, and I'll make a note in the margin, or I'll highlight something, and I have this grandiose idea. One of these days, I'll be dead, and my grandchildren are going to be sitting there reading John Owen, Volume 7, and they're going to say, look, Papa highlighted this. This must be important. And look at that marginal note there. That is really good. I didn't even know he knew Greek. And I think, that'll be wonderful. And then I wake up. And the books that I've cherished, and the books that I'll leave, who knows what's going to happen to him? John Owen may end up at Goodwill. Okay? Really? And you know what? I won't care. I won't. I'll actually get to talk to John Owen in person. So this pretty dark part of the forest actually reminds us God is sovereign and we're laden with limitations. We are limited people. And the prosperity and the stuff that we yearn for, that comes from God's hand, as does the power to enjoy it. And so I would just remind all of us that money, wealth, reputation, those things are not the key to a happy life. Those things cannot satisfy us, even if wisdom is added. Oh, you can enjoy the gift, but it will not do for you what only God can do. And so the call of Ecclesiastes 6 is to find satisfaction in life as God has given it to you. You do see how important that statement is, don't you? The call is to enjoy life as God has given it to you. God didn't give you somebody else's life. He gave you your life. And by the way, go back to chapter 4. What does envy do? If I look at it with discontent at my life and I wish that my life wasn't my life, but that person's life was my life, then you know what? At the end of the day, I'm going to be an absolutely miserable person. The key to actually living this life to the glory of God is receiving it as the gift that He gave it to me. With its hardships, with its pains, with its glories, with its joys, all of those things. And if you don't enjoy the life that God's given to you, if you're the irrepressible complainer, if you are the utterly the one who is never ever content, just a discontented person and always grumbling against God, Solomon says, a stillborn baby's better off than you. The old Anglican Jeremy Taylor said many years ago, God threatens terrible things against us if we will not be happy. How are you happy? Enjoy the life that God has given to you as He has given it. Let's pray. Father, we thank You that Your Word is not interested in tickling our ears and serving us candy-coated pablum. We thank You that sometimes Your Word is really rough with us and is even at times brutal. And we thank You for the love and yet brutality of truth. And Father, we pray tonight that You would really drive these things home to us. And Father, we live in an affluent world. We live in an affluent area. We have a lot. And Father, we pray that we would truly look to You as the giver of all good things. We would enjoy what You've given, and we would enjoy the life that You've given to us for Your glory. And may we be thankful for every passing day. In Jesus' name, amen.
We hope that you were edified by this message. For additional sermons as well as information on giving to the ministry of Grace Community Church, please visit us online at gracenevada.com. That's gracenevada.com.